How did you first become involved in the fight against the death penalty?
I actually became involved in the struggle against the death penalty in 1995, at the time when Mumia was facing execution. And I was part of an organization, I still am, called the Radical Philosophy Association, which is an association of philosophers who basically see philosophy not as an armchair activity, but as an activity that leads to changing society. And everybody wanted to organize to defend Mumia. And we realized very soon in the discussion we were having that the issue was also broader than Mumia, was the issue of the death penalty. And so we constituted an anti-death penalty project. And I worked on that issue for several years. But at the same time, I've been alerted to the importance of the death penalty in the contemporary political context also years before, when I've been teaching in Nigeria in the mid-80s. And I noticed, reading the newspapers, that there was a continuous increase in the number of executions. And looking at the people who were being executed, I realized that many were, workers and peasants or students, people who had been pauperized and had committed some theft with arms. Sometimes they had not necessarily killed a person. Sometimes they had wounded a person. But clearly they had been driven to these crimes, by a process of pauperization, by a process of immiseration. And very soon I connected the escalation of this type of crime and this type of repression also, because these were clearly people who I believe that nobody, deserved the death penalty. I believe the death penalty should definitely be eliminated. But in any case, these people were clearly not the candidate for capital punishment. And so the question was why such severe punishment was being meted to them. And I came to the conclusion, analyzing also what was happening with the economy, what was happening with the politics of the country at the time, and the fact that the country was undergoing, a process of economic crisis and was going through a period of fiscal austerity. And it was clear that there was a connection between the type of, impoverishment and that people were facing on a general level, and of course the kind of resistance that was being mobilized against this impoverishment, and the introduction of very, very severe punishments of the type that I was witnessing in Port Harcourt and nationwide. So this was the first time in Nigeria when I began to make a connection between capital punishment and, not only economic crisis, but the process that, later became known as globalization.
So that was your first introduction to that idea, and where have you gone since then with those connections between capital punishment, globalization, and slavery?
Well, that connection became even more clear when I came back to the United States and in 1986-87. And throughout the 80s and the 90s, what you had in the United States, you had a double process. First, you had the increase in the number of people incarcerated. In fact, a continuous increase that has led now to a situation where you have 2 million people in jail, so an astounding number. And we also had, the reintroduction of capital punishment, which had been suspended in 1972 and then was reintroduced in 1976, but really applied on an increasing level, you know, in the 80s and 90s, you know, to the point that now we have about 3,500 people on death row. And in the United States too, it became soon clear that there was a parallel between the increase in the number of people incarcerated and the whole policy of mass incarceration, as well as the extensive application of the death penalty. And at the same time, you know, the policy that was initially called Reaganism and, you know, later neoliberalism, but basically a policy that has cut, you know, substantially into people's entitlements, into workers' rights, that has, you know, attempted to eliminate and has succeeded in to a great extent, you know, in eliminate the gains that the workers have made, and, you know, a policy that has, in a sense, represented a retrenchment on all levels, you know, economically, from the point of view, you know, of people's rights and people's economic entitlements. So soon we began to, with other people I've been working with, we developed an analysis that started connecting the death penalty to what we called, you know, at the time as the return of a kind of plantation economy. You know, plantation economy in the sense of a return of a policy, economic policy, based upon the existence of a large workforce deprived of basic rights. And of a policy, you know, tending to reduce to the maximum the cost of labor, and you know, amplify the forms of labor that are not guaranteed, and that are precarious. You know, this of course now is generalized. So, the in our analysis, clearly there was a connection. A very tight connection between, you know, the economic attack that has been waged through the 80s and 90s, you know, on workers in the States and also in other parts of the world, and the introduction of more severe punishment, including the death penalty.
How exactly do you see the role of the death penalty playing into that new economic reality? What's its role? What does it do?
Right. Well, I think here, you know, in answering that, I think what can help us is to look at what has been the history of the death penalty, you know, and the function that the penalty has, you know, served historically, and looking at the United States, you know, you have a very good window on that, because the death penalty has always been the punishment for the slaves. The only way you can punish a slave is by taking away his or her life. And in fact, in the United States, the reason why the U.S. has continued to hold on to the death penalty is clearly connected, you know, to the fact of slavery. You know, the death penalty fulfills many different functions. I mean, as I said, it's generally connected, you know, to the attack on workers' rights, to the attack, you know, on the value of people's labor, and on the guarantees the workers have won with their struggles. But it has multiple functions. Within that horizon, within that framework, it has multiple functions. First of all, it basically, you know, creates scapegoats for the sense of insecurity and frustration, you know, that people feel, and very much exonerates the state, you know, for the responsibility of the social responsibility for the general deterioration of people's life, you know, and it creates a target, you know, it sort of creates a target which people can look to say, well, you know, life is really bad and it's becoming more insecure, you know, because there are bad apples among us. And if only those bad apples could be eliminated, then everything in the society would be all right. So in a sense, it deflects people's anger and frustration, you know, from what would be a different target. And it certainly serves to divide society, to divide people at a time in which, in different ways, they all come under attack. Right? It's really an instrument of division, because, you know, it creates a situation in which, you know, people feel that there's a kind of enemy within. And it also has the function of, redefining what is the most serious source of threat and insecurity in people's lives. You know, all the stress in the media, you know, on these killers, these so-called animals, the way often people call these people, you know, the criminals, generates the impression that, the guy with the knife waiting in the alley for you is really the worst threat and the worst cause and most intense cause of insecurity in your life. And it hides the fact that, in fact, most people are more likely to die of, what some would call corporate crime or the very, very avoidable causes that have to do with environmental pollution, that have to do with hazardous condition in the workplace, that have to do with lack of health care, which have to do with all kinds of social and business policies, and not to mention work accidents, which are not considered crime. So that there is an ideological construction that instrumentalizes also the death penalty, which defines and redefines what is crime and what is not, what people should be fearing and what they should not be fearing. This is very powerful, because in fact most people do not look, for example, at a disaster in a mine, even when that disaster could have been prevented, and when it was announced because that mine was not complying with safety regulation. But now, in fact, most people do not consider that as murder. In fact, it would not be called murder. It would be called an accident, right? So there is a very powerful displacement as to the sources of insecurity, the sources of threat. And the death penalty is not only a reflection, right? It's definitely not only a reflection of the division that exists in society, but it's also a means to produce them, to intensify them. So I think in the case of globalization, the death penalty, it's a powerful, instrument in that, it intensified all the fears and maximizes all the fears that people have had about their life, about their future, about the sense of insecurity, and concentrate them in a number of people who become the embodiment of all the evil in society.
So you talked about the historical connections between the death penalty and slavery in the United States, and perhaps that's one example of a difference between why the death penalty still exists in the United States, if you're going to compare it to Europe, and look at Europe and see that they're actively opposing capital punishment. Do you have any other comments on how the differences in terms of the role of capital punishment plays, or why it plays out the way it does in those two different societies?
Yeah, it's very interesting, you know, because Europe and the United States have gone opposite way in the same, although both Europe and the United States have gone through a process, you know, of fiscal austerity, and in both cases, you know, again, the advance of the global economy has eroded, you know, people's working condition and people's entitlement. But nevertheless, they've gone different places as far as the death penalty. And I am glad you're asking this question, because I want to correct some of the, I think, misunderstanding that people have, at least in the United States, I don't know, in Canada, on this point, you know. People look at Europe as being kind of more civilized and or at least among anti-death penalty activists. And they explain the difference, you know, while Europe is on a higher level culturally. Often they try to shame the United States by saying, you see, the United States is with the more barbaric country. And I think it's a very dangerous argument on many levels. I would say first that Europe has gone through a process that, you know, the United States has not gone through. And that process, in particularly, in countries like France, Italy, Germany, and to a less extent England, you know, the experience of Nazism and the experience of World War II, but above all the experience of fascism and Nazism, you know, has been very, very important in changing people's attitudes on a mass level with respect to the death penalty. Because Nazism, you know, and fascism use extensively the death penalty against their opponents. And at the end of World War II, there was a general revulsion, you know, against the death penalty. In fact, interesting enough, the countries in which the opposition to the death penalty has been the highest have exactly been the same countries that have had directly the experience of fascism and Nazism, right? People understood, you know, very well the connection between the kind of the attempted enslavement that was at the heart of Nazi policies, right? The fact that, you know, Nazism in a sense, in a way, you know, was an attempt to introduce slavery into Europe. And the use of the death penalty. And not accidentally, you know, at the end of World War II, you begin to have a process in which the death penalty is either abolished or suspended, not used even when it remained on the books. And by the way, I want to make this connection between slavery and capital punishment. You see it again in the fact that as soon as South Africa, right, you know, eliminated apartheid, at least, you know, formally, it also eliminated capital punishment. That the end of apartheid, right, was also the end of capital punishment, you know, because the connection again between slavery and capital punishment has been so powerful, and it's entered in South Africa as well, you know, the consciousness of people on the mass level. Now, in Europe, and here the second factor, I think, that makes a difference. The globalization process, too, has been more resisted, right? Yes, there's been an attack on wages. There has been an attack on workers' rights. But that attack has not gone as far, or at least has met a higher level of resistance than it has met in the States. And actually, you know, the recent event in France, you know, where the attempt to introduce these short-term contracts and you know, a two-tier level of work relations and short-term underpaid work contracts, you know, for youth, for first entry workers, has been resisted and has brought a mass mobilization, a really general mobilization, is an example of this resistance. And generally speaking, again, I would say that in Europe, you don't have the type of division, you know, the type of division that you have in the United States, you know, in particular division between black workers, white workers, and of course, increasingly, you know, Hispanic workers. So that the kind of biases and prejudices and divisions that have been, you know, so powerfully maintained and recreated in American society have not been present in Europe. And this is another reason why it's difficult, right, to demonize people to the extent that is necessary to have the death penalty. However, you know, however, I don't believe, let's put it this way, it's possible that things may also change. And I mention that because, you know, recently the level of anti-immigrant, you know, sentiment that has been mobilized, you know, starting from the highest level, you know, from at the governmental levels, of the individual government and of the EU as a whole, you know, has been such, you know, that one has to fear for the worst and one has to be very much on guard. For instance, now, you know, for at least since September 11, you know, increasingly, you know, there's been more and more the tendency by, you know, all different governments of Europe to target and finger illegal immigrants, what we would call undocumented immigrants, as the carriers of everything, crime, terrorism. In fact, more and more, the so-called war on terror is becoming a war on immigrant workers. And it's not just a war that affects only undocumented immigrant, but is affecting also every immigrant, immigrant community who have residency permits, work permits, because new legislation is being introduced that, for example, in Italy, that allows immigrant community to be raided, you know, if they supposedly harbor people who are suspected of terrorism. And, for instance, asylum rights are now practically being scratched, you know. There is almost no asylum rights really now, you know, in Europe. The possibility of having asylum is so reduced that it's almost nil. Detention centers have proliferated everywhere. There are now 72 detention centers in the space of the EU. And more have been constructed on the borders as well as in countries of transit. And the Mediterranean is becoming a grave for immigrants coming from Africa, the Middle East, as one shipwreck after another of boats carrying immigrants, you know, is taking place due to the kind of policy that is being pursued, whereby these boats have been chased, you know, in high seas, and you know, people are often not allowed to land. And so I mentioned these very important developments, you know, because I'm concerned by a sense of you know, the false security that people should not rely on some sort of, you know, higher level of civilization in among European people. I want to also add another important difference with regard to the death penalty in Europe, you know, historically, which is that Europe externalized the worst forms of exploitation. In other words, Europe had the colonies, you know, in Africa, in Asia, you know, out of its territories. So even the countries that had the death penalty, you know, England, France, and so forth, they did not use the death penalty in the way it was used within the United States, because the worst repression that England and France and Holland, you know, organized was in the colonies. So to look at the history of the death penalty in European country, you also have to look at the history of the death penalty in Kenya, in the Congo, etc., etc., because that's where you see what traditionally the use of, you know, European country death penalty has been.
And getting on now a little bit more in terms of the movements against the death penalty, I know you've written about how there's a lack of feminist analysis in the struggle against the death penalty. Maybe you can tell us why feminists should oppose the death penalty.
You know, I am a feminist, and I've been concerned that feminists have not been really present in the 80s and 70s in the struggle against the death penalty, at least in the United States. You know, even in the debates, there's not been a feminist viewpoint in the debates on the death penalty in the U.S. And, you know, periodically I review the literature, and so far the literature has been very, very limited. And it has concentrated on analyzing the situation of women on death row, the kind of crimes for which they have been sentenced to capital punishment, and the sexual stereotypes that have played into these sentences. You know, for example, it is very clear that some women who were sentenced to the death penalty, like the most famous case is Eileen Wuornos, were sentenced this way because they were lesbian, and her lesbianism played an important part in the second trial, the trial in which the sentence is meted, right? So that the fact of being perceived as non-feminine, as breaking the feminine norm, is very often what has made the difference between a life in prison or a prison sentence and a capital punishment sentence. And also, you know, feminists have very, very, you know, powerfully looked at the different ways, you know, the differences in which women on death row are treated, right, compared with men. You know, the fact that the level of mistreatment, it's much higher. And of course, nobody has, the conditions on death row are appalling for everybody. But mistreatment is particularly severe in the case of women, and who are also often subject to sexual assaults by the guards. And but there hasn't been a feminist viewpoint in what the death penalty means. And the reason why I think is important is, first of all, you know, because feminism is a position, right, that fights against, you know, divisions, and fights against, you know, any attempt, you know, to divide people, whether it is, you know, along the line of sex or age or race. And clearly the death penalty is a means of division. The death penalty itself, you know, produces the idea, right, that is, and it's based on the idea that there are certain people who are not human, who are not human beings, who are so irrecuperable, right, so inhuman, and so just evil that anything can be done to them, right? And on this very ground, I think the feminist should oppose the death penalty, right? And a second reason is that particularly in the 80s and 90s, the death penalty has been defended by his supporters with new arguments that, in a sense, are kind to manipulate, you know, are you know, people's emotions and feelings. For example, this idea that the death penalty gives closure, and that the death penalty is, you know, in a sense, brings peace to the families of the victims. And also, in the course of the trials, more and more, the courts have allowed the description of killings, the description of the victimization to, in particular, you know, women who have been murdered, have been subjected to. They have allowed that to be part of, you know, a trial procedure. All of this, I think, has generated many distortions. And I think that women in general, feminists, should be particularly vocal in challenging this distortion. You know, for example, the concept of closure, right? Over and over, it's becoming clear that the death penalty cannot bring closure to the families of murder victims. You know, that in fact, the fact that the person was, you know, abused and violated and killed, you know, a relative, is executed, you know, many times leaves an emptiness that can never be filled. You know, that people, in fact, have been able either to forgive or at least to try to come in contact, you know, with the murderer, have had a better success, a better, you know, possibility to achieve some peace. And also another, you know, issue that is very important from the point of view of feminists, basically they are the ones who have it, I think, the best possibility to raise it, you know, is the fact that, you know, in our society, men are very much trained to, you know, to be aggressive, that part of the definition of masculinity, has been aggressiveness. And in fact, in the 80s and 90s, with the continuous proliferation of war, right, the fact that war has become practically an essential component of the globalization process, right, the model of the masculine male and the model of, you know, the man with the gun has become the kind of a model of masculinity. And so here we are as women, right, very much at the center of this contradiction, in the sense that we have a state and governments who increasingly are relaunching a model of masculinity and men that is identified with violence. You know, the Rambo man, right? The soldier with all the gear and so forth. And at the same time, when people perpetrate, act upon, become violent in everyday life, right? Then these people are fingered, you know, as subhuman. And it's again another example of how the state basically exonerates itself from any responsibility for the existence of crime. So again, and you know, this is an important issue that needs to be raised. But ultimately, I think that where feminists have a special role in relation to the question of punishment and to the question of a death penalty, right, is to point out that what the death penalty does is a massive devaluation of human life, and a devaluation also of all the reproductive work that you know, women engage in when they raise their children. It is very ironic that when women face a crisis as mother, you know, in the attempt to give their children the best in life. And when they don't have available the resources that are necessary to do that, you know, the state is absent. The state is not there. You know, that child is their individual problem. But when that child, because of the trauma that he or she may have experienced in childhood, and because of the different forms of deprivation and the angers they may have developed because of the deprivation, commits a crime, you know, then the state comes in. And in the case of the death penalty, right, punishes not only the child but also the mother. You know, in fact, the capital punishment is really capital punishment also on the parents, and in particular the mothers of those who are condemned, you know, as well as the children of those who are condemned. You know, try to imagine what can be the pain of a woman who knows that her child is going to be executed, you know? And what can be the pain of a child, of a person who is going to be executed? How, for example, the child can continue to live in a society, you know, who has executed his father or her father, right? So that, you know, capital punishment, it's such an irreparable, absolute punishment that destroys, you know, not only the immediate condemned, the person who had been condemned, but also their families, you know, who are, you know, basically deprived of the possibility of any relationship, you know, with their beloved. And, you know, I've come to think of capital punishment as the ultimate father right, you know, prevailing over the right of mothers and the right of parenting and the rights of the people, you know, who are raising children, you know, who also, you know, have a claim on the society in the sense of expecting, you know, the children that they raise to also be protected. So this is what I think, that all this cluster of issues, you know, are issues that I think can be most powerfully, you know, put forward, you know, by women and women who have a feminist consciousness. Because I think that if we want to build a society that is, you know, free from exploitation, free from any form of divisions and antagonism, and from any form of dehumanization, right? We do have to eliminate the death penalty. You know, the death penalty is the most dehumanizing, you know, form of punishment, of policy, you know, that a society can have, and is dehumanizing for those who are condemned, and is dehumanizing also for those, you know, who are implementing it. Because let's not forget that when you support capital punishment, you're also supporting the fact that some people has to kill, you know, those to whom capital punishment will be administered. And so in the very process of administering capital punishment, we create more murderers.
Just wanted to get your perspective on what you think the movement to abolish the death penalty, particularly in the United States, what do you think they should be doing? What's your assessment of the movement against the death penalty in the United States at the moment?
The movement against the death penalty has gone through some transformations, through some changes. And I would say that the movement has expanded and has become stronger and, you know, more effective. Because until the mid-90s, you know, basically the movement against the death penalty was composed of a very limited number of organizations. Most of them are religious organizations, and organizations that moved in a perspective of civil rights. But by the end of the 90s, and over the last 4 or 5 years, in fact, the movement has made a leap. In fact, there is a momentum now to abolish the death penalty. In other words, the issue of abolition of the death penalty, or at least the issue of a moratorium, is not as far-fetched as it seemed. Right? Why? Because I think that the American public, until more or less the late 90s, right, was told that everybody was in favor of the death penalty. Whether this was true or whether this was exaggerated by the media, it's not something that I'm going to address now. But certainly there was this impression, and the media and would continuously confirm it, that everybody wanted, or a large majority of Americans wanted, the death penalty. Well, it has become clear and recognized that this is not any longer the case. And one major issue, one major change that has taken place is that, more and more people are becoming aware of the number of innocent people who have been sentenced to death, and only by sheer luck, very, very many times they came close to execution, and by a fluke, they were saved. In fact, in the state of Illinois, so many people, 13 people, were found to be innocent, basically as a product of law students picking up some cases that were law and media students, picking up some cases, reviewing them, as part of their homework, and discovering that there was no basis for their sentencing to death. Upon that, Governor Ryan basically decided to put a moratorium on execution, which is still standing. And the publicity around that, and of course that has involved also publicity about the many, many inequities of the death penalty, the fact that the death penalty is racially biased, that the number of people who are being condemned to die is disproportionate, disproportionately penalizing black people, that you can be condemned to death for executing a white person if you are a black person, whereas the opposite is not the case, that many people on death row are people who are poor, who do not have the resources to have good lawyers, basically, improprieties by the police and by the judicial authorities. All of that is now becoming part of the general consciousness, and people are recognizing that this is not far from a full, not only is not a foolproof system, but is also a system that is incredibly inequitable and dangerous. And as a result of that, there has been a trend, towards basically in many cases, people have supported politicians who have taken position against capital punishment. And all of this has given a boost, to the anti-death penalty organizations, has given a boost to the anti-death penalty movement. And in addition to that, the anti-death penalty movement has also expanded in terms of its composition, because partially due to the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, more and more the social movements, anti-globalization movements, you know, progressive movements, you know, I've begun to see that the question of the death penalty, as well as the question of mass incarceration, are political questions. And so which had not been the case in the past. The death penalty for a long time had been ignored by, you know, for example, left organizations. And it's only starting with the campaign for Mumia Abu-Jamal that this has changed. Right? So there's been the movement itself, the anti-death penalty movement has gone through a period of change. Nevertheless, having said all of this, I think that some of the perspectives that, you know, dominate within the movement, you know, are not sufficient to really wage the kind of struggle and produce the kind of mobilization that I think is necessary to eliminate the death penalty. And one of the things that needs to be done is to make the connection between the death penalty, as well as mass incarceration, and the economic policies that are being promoted by financial organization, by the corporate world, by the government, etc. And that is a connection that is very important to be made, because in a way, you know, that many people who support the death penalty, they do so because they have a false sense of safety. A false sense of safety. They think that the death penalty is going to make their life, particularly among the middle class, more safe. But also among certain sectors of the working class, there is this illusion that somehow, you know, heavier punishment and extreme punishment, you know, despite some of the risks that are involved, are going to make their life more safe. And they do not realize, you know, in my view, that in fact the opposite is the case. That in fact the death penalty generates a dangerously illusory sense of safety. Because in fact the death penalty, you know, it's part of the production of the kind of divisions, and it's part of the process of deflection as to the real issues and displacement and masking of the real issues that allows for the continuation of policies that in fact are depriving people of their, you know, most basic, you know, means of subsistence and the kind of guarantees that will give them real security rather than false security. Not to mention the society based on this type of division and on this type of dehumanization. You know, it's a society, cannot give, you know, the people any safety. So unfortunately, you know, many anti-death penalty organizations are afraid of touching anything that may sound like politics and want to concentrate on the humanitarian aspect, right? Or they want to concentrate on the fact that the system is biased. And sure enough, you can go a long way in showing the bias, because the system, when you come near to the death penalty, is right there that you see to an intensity and an extreme, you know, all the inequities of the so-called justice system as it is configured at present. And by the way, since 1996, in fact, you know, under Clinton, and even before 1996, actually starting from the early 90s, you know, there has been a process of continuous erosion of the kind of guarantees that were supposed to, you know, make sure the innocent people would not be condemned, right? And one guarantee in particular, very, very important, has been practically eliminated, and that's called the habeas corpus. And the habeas corpus, it's a clause, it's a statute in American legislation. In fact, it goes back to the English Bill of Rights, which was then introduced in the American juridical system, whereby a defendant who has been condemned, you know, by a state court, you know, can bring his case or her case for review to the federal court. And this, the habeas corpus, the importance of it was especially revealed during the civil rights movement, you know, when sentences that were, you know, meted out in the South against black people, because they were reviewed, you know, because they were reviewed, were able to be overturned. In fact, in the case of capital punishment, there has been an average of half of state-imposed sentences being overturned, and in some cases even more than half being overturned once they get into a federal court. Now, however, you know, through the 90s, their right to habeas corpus has been continuously eroded to the point whereby today innocence does not constitute a defense, which means that the laws about capital punishment have been reformulated in such a restrictive way that if new evidence emerges after you had your day in court, after you've gone through a certain procedure, new evidence emerges showing that you are innocent, right? The judge has the right, has the prerogative to decide whether that evidence will be considered or not. In other words, you are 10 days from execution, you've gone through all your appellate, you know, procedures, and you have been sentenced to die, and then somebody confesses that they are the killers and they can prove it. The judge is not compelled any longer to review the case, right? And the ability of a condemned to turn to the federal government has been very, very, very severely reduced. So that in fact, today, more than ever, the possibility of mistakes, the possibility of innocent people to be condemned, right? It's very, very high. Now, anti-death penalty organizations are using those arguments, and these are powerful arguments. But again, I repeat that in my view, this is not enough. And a really mass campaign and the mobilization, in my view, can only be obtained, you know, once capital punishment is shown to be part of a whole broader policy that, you know, involves the whole, you know, economic issues and the whole, the policy planning of the government with regard to economic life and how this affects regular people.